This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who has strong words for the Federal Reserve after both the Silicon Valley Bank failure and another hike in interest rates this week. We caught up with the senator just this morning, and I started with a yes or no question. Is the U.S. banking system sound and resilient, as the Fed has said?
Oh, can I do hope so?
Yeah, you can.
Look, it's clear that the Treasury and the Fed have taken extraordinary steps to strengthen the banking system and to reassure depositors that they're not going to lose any money. But remember the problem that brought us here, and that is weakening the oversight of these multi-billion dollar banks. And it's going to take a little while to turn around and go back and really put these banks through the tough paces of what happens if this happens. You know, that's what stress tests are about. What are their capital reserves look like? And so on, so that we are sure that we really do have a strong and resilient system. This is part of the reason that I, along with some other senators, are calling on the Fed right now to tighten down on the regulations that they spent the last 5 years loosening, and to go back and do tough supervision over these banks. That's the best way to make sure that they are safe. Now, Congress still has a job to do here as well to tighten up the regulations, but the Fed could act literally today.
All right. So part of the reference there is to the rollback of Dodd-Frank in 2018. And I've also noticed, you know, a lot of comments from you this week that even after that rollback, you feel the Fed had autonomy. Jerome Powell had autonomy to do some regulatory things that he chose not to do, sort of saying, hey, that rollback says I have to loosen things. You have fundamentally disagreed with that. Is that correct?
Yes. So think of it this way. If I can, I'll do it fast, a little bit longer history here in the run-up. After the crash, we put Dodd-Frank in place, said all of the big banks, that is those over $50 billion, are going to be under tighter regulations, because if one of them fails, they put everybody at risk and force the government to come in and start talking about rescue. So those big banks didn't like that. And it came to Congress. They started lobbying. Donald Trump ran for president saying, I'll weaken the regulations on those multi-billion dollar banks. He got elected. He put in regulators that in many ways were anti-regulators. Then he went to Congress in 2018 and he said, I want you by statute to weaken the regulations and open the door for lighter regulations. That's what happened. Jerome Powell, chairman of the Fed, said, I'm going to take that authority and I'm going to weaken the regulations even more. He literally weakened dozens of regulations. And I, of course, at the time was saying, no, 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 no. And I said, what will happen is you weaken across the board like that, the banks will load up on risk, boost their short-term profits, and then some of them are going to explode.
And that brings us
what we've seen happen.
That brings us to Silicon Valley Bank. And I want to note, and you have noted this, you noted the Trump administration, you noted Jerome Powell, but you've also noted that both Democrats and Republicans in Congress in 2018 participated in this rollback of Dodd-Frank. I'm going to bring us now, that history is helpful for the context, because I'm going to bring us to Wednesday of this week now, and the Fed's decision to raise interest rates by another 0.25%. NPR, and they've said they're doing that to try to lower inflation. NPR's reporting inflation's now at 6%, down roughly from 9% last June, still above the Fed's target of 2%. I want to play you a little sound from Raphael Bostic, who is the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta head. He was with Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition this morning. Here he is.
We have to get inflation under control and back down to our target. We are going to have to see demand come down. Inflation is high because there's more demand than supply. And one of the ways that you're going to see that demand come down is by seeing the economy slow down.
Okay, so two questions. First, I'm struck by the fact that you have said that the Fed is overly focused on using interest rates as the way to bring inflation down. Can you explain that?
Sure. There are a lot of things that can cause prices to go up. And right now, we know three things that are particularly boosting prices. One is price gouging. In all of the industries where there's a lot of concentration, meaning there are just, you know, one or two giant companies, profit margins have gone up and prices have gone through the roof.
Can you give an example of that, like a particular kind of company or product?
So, for example, we've seen it in shipping, in transport, that prices are way up, and then that gets reflected in prices everywhere. Small businesses can't do anything about it if their shipping costs go up, because it means the prices of what they buy and what they send out have to go up. So one is price gouging. Two is supply chain kinks. We're still having trouble with that. And three, of course, the war in Ukraine, which has an impact both on food prices worldwide and on energy prices. So those are things. I've actually asked Jerome Powell about this in hearings. Does raising interest rates help bring down the cost of any of those? And the answer is, he said, no, it doesn't.
So are you saying that interest rates are not also a part of this equation? You said three things, and interest rates wasn't on that list.
I said, that's right. Those are three things that are helping push prices up. Now, what the Fed is doing under Jerome Powell is they're saying, we're going to raise interest rates. And you notice the language that Mr. Bostic used. He said, what's going to happen is we're going to try to reduce demand, which is economists speak for, we're going to try to get a lot of people laid off. That is, businesses to cut back on the number of people they employ, because if people are laid off, they won't get out there and buy as much stuff.
And so you are arguing that this is a direct attempt at job loss, creation of job loss.
I don't have to argue it. That is actually what the Fed itself says in its own reports. The Fed says their target, listen to that word, target, is to increase unemployment by one full point over the next year. That's 2 million jobs. I know it's 2 million jobs. That's just plain old arithmetic. And here's the really scary part about that. Out of the last 12 times, the 12 times in modern history where unemployment has gone up by a full point in a calendar year, the country has gone into a recession. And here's just as if that's not bad enough. In 11 of the 12 times when unemployment has increased by a full point in a year, it has then overshot the target. That is, you can't stop at a full point. Once an economy starts shedding jobs, it sheds more and more jobs. So I asked Chair Powell about this when he was in front of the Senate Finance Committee. What's your plan if you get the 2 million people knocked out of work that you're trying to push out of work? How do you stop it at that point? And basically the answer was there is no plan for that. So this is why I don't think the Fed ought to be raising interest rates at such an extreme rate. We have not seen hikes at this speed before in our economy in recent years.
So let's pivot now. And you've been very clear that you believe Jerome Powell should not be the chair of the Federal Reserve. I want to pivot to the price strains, right? So Boston Herald has an article this morning about the rising level of food insecurity, has an employee of the Salvation Army saying, I can't go buy eggs anymore. And so 6% is a lot higher than 2%. What's the path that in the next, you know, 6 months, we get from 6% to 2%, given the complexity of what you're saying is putting pressure on prices?
So I see this as you got to attack this problem on all fronts. Let's start with the price gouging. Congresswoman Katie Porter and I have really been on top of the egg industry and really pushing them hard about why have you guys increased prices like this? It's not because your costs have gone up.
I thought it was bird flu. Honestly, I thought it was bird flu.
Well, there was a period of time when they said we had to kill off some of our birds and we have lower supply. I get it. The supply and demand work. But part of what we also are watching in different places is that a concentration in the industry means that it's the manufacturers, it's the dominant company that is sucking up more and more profits. And by the way, the reason I know this is twofold. One is just look at the profitability reports over the last year from these big companies, and it correlates. Where there's less competition, the profits went up faster. But the second reason I know this is that the CEOs in these companies actually brag on their earnings calls that inflation is turning out to be great for them.
So,
because it means they can raise prices not just to cover the rise in expenses, they can raise it more than that, and everybody shrugs and says, in effect, what are you going to do? That's inflation. So what I'm trying to say is there are multiple problems here, and we need to think of it as approaching it with multiple solutions. We cannot say that because the Fed has a hammer, that everything will yield like a nail.
So last question, Senator, and I'm mindful that your team has told us you're on a limited time schedule. So last question to you. Can that be done within a reasonable time frame? 6 months, full court press? I made up the 6 months, but people are looking for relief.
Right. I think it can be, as long as we're pushing on all fronts. And sure, the Fed is part of the solution, but so is the Federal Trade Commission. So are state attorneys general. So is the president using his bully pulpit. All of the above. After all, we've taken inflation, as you started out, from 9% down to 6%. It's headed in the right direction. We just need to give it a stronger push and get it down faster.
All right. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, always great to have you. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
The next of our ongoing kitchen table conversations with members of our congressional delegation. We hear a lot about what they're working on in Congress, but not necessarily a lot about why. So let's get to know the people representing the state in Washington better. Today, Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan. Trahan has met a lot of crossroads in her life, from what to do after college to her choice to run for office. And she told us about that when we sat down with her earlier this week. Over a couple of oat milk lattes, and it turns out those are really good, I started by asking her a simple but complicated question. Who is she?
I was born Lori Lerrero, and I was born in Lowell, Massachusetts, like a lot of people in Lowell. My grandparents were immigrants, you know, one from my grandmother from Brazil, my grandfather from Portugal. And you can imagine almost when you grow up in a community of immigrants, the value system that is just innate, right? It's hard work, persistence, a commitment to education and finding economic opportunity at all costs. We grew up in the same house, very small, modest house, one bathroom. But I had three sisters, and we were just close, and we were all working at young ages, and we saw how my parents sort of fit so much into a day, and I think it was expected of all of us to do the same, to contribute to our household. And that upbringing really serves me well. You know, certainly I'm maybe a little bit known for not taking no for an answer. I rarely hear the word no, just maybe not yet. And that keeps me innovating on how I get to yes. And also just a very strong, you know, sense of work and purpose. So, yeah, we were one of those families that lived paycheck to paycheck. My dad was a union iron worker. My mom juggled multiple part-time minimum wage jobs while raising my three sisters and me. And we didn't have much, but we had all the necessary ingredients to have happy childhood and a sense of pitching in and supporting one another that went beyond our family many times, to our neighborhood, to our community. And probably that's where I got rooted in service. You know, we had a close-knit community and a very close-knit family. So
I used to run an organization where one of the things that we would do when a new person came in, we would do this mapping exercise. We'd put a map, one of the United States and one of the world, and these pushpins, and we would say, tell your story.
Hmm.
And one of the things I learned really early on is where people start their story tells you a lot, right? Some people say, well, my grandparents were born in such and such.
Mm-hmm.
And other people say, well, I came to Boston in such and such, right? You started not just at birth with your family, but with Lorero specifically. Why?
I think a lot of people in Lowell are very much rooted in their heritage. It's an immigrant city. It's one where many waves of people have kind of come through and found their way. If I think about my grandmother, she was a mill girl, worked in a textile mill in Lowell. She worked in several. In my lifetime, I've watched those mill buildings that, you know, was literally the start of our industrial revolution. And with so many women workers, I mean, you think about the strikes for, you know, fairer conditions, safer working conditions. Those were born from women immigrants who worked in these mills. And my congressional office today is in one of those mill buildings. And so I feel very connected to what my grandmother pursued when she came here and the nobility of her just wanting to provide a better life for her family and for future generations of her family.
I'm imagining you kind of walking into the space and almost, this sounds so, I don't know, sort of the echoes of your ancestors, right? And you're in Congress.
Yes.
And I didn't get the sense in studying that there had been a, okay, first I'm going to go to college and then I'm going to get X job and then by the time I'm 40, I'm going to run for office, right?
No.
It wasn't like that.
No.
But you did have a moment where you realized, oh, wait, maybe I'm the one who should run.
Mm.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
It's funny. There were certain things I knew I wanted to do and pursue. I knew at a very early age I wanted to go to Georgetown. I wanted to get into the School of Foreign Service. I wanted to be a diplomat. That's what I thought I was going to be, a Foreign Service officer. And I changed course for a bunch of reasons, but my dad got sick while I was in college. He was diagnosed with MS, and I wanted to come home. It's, you know, an unpredictable disease. We didn't know, you know, what was in store for my family, for my dad. And I worked in a congressional office for my hometown congressman, Marty Meehan, at the time, and probably got a little bit of the bug in terms of what can be done in a congressional office to help people, to help communities. But then I changed course. You know, when Newt Gingrich came to town and started running the House of Representatives, it became a bit more divisive. I went to the private sector. And truthfully, there's a lot of talk between staffers. Are you going to run for office? And I was always a hard no.
Interesting.
It is interesting to look back on. I very much loved the ability to help people and to use the office, whether it was help in an economic development project, help someone with a social security issue. There's just a huge breadth of issues that the office can help with. And I loved that. And it got me out of bed every day, you know, running to work. But never thought I would run myself. Went to the private sector for 13 years. And I think my first look back at the Congress was when President Trump got elected. I was very concerned about what would happen to future generations. I was looking at in the eyes of my two daughters, who were very young at the time, and then looked at the Congress as a whole and thought, wow, there aren't as many women as I would have expected. Well, little did I know that there were thousands of women having the same thought bubble across the country. And in 2018, when the opportunity arose, I'll never forget that moment. I was in a hotel room in Seattle, and I had just seen the news that Congresswoman Tsongas was retiring. No one, I think, was expecting her retirement. Certainly I wasn't. But I had a moment of clarity that, you know, you just don't get many of those in your life. And I called my husband immediately, and I told him. I said, you know, I'm flying home tonight, but I'm running for Congresswoman Tsongas' seat. I'm going to run.
And you just told him.
I did. I said, well, you know, I'm sure you've got questions, concerns. Maybe you want to talk me out of it. We'll talk about it when I get home. But I feel really strongly about it. I've lived here my whole life. It's just something I'm ready to do. And that's with a full picture of the sacrifices that, you know, we as a family would make.
Has it been a lot of sacrifices?
I think for any working mom, for any woman, I mean, it is. It's a sacrifice. I mean, the logistics of the job takes you away from home a lot. The events tend to get in the way of breakfast time and dinner time and bedtime. There are certainly sacrifices.
How old were they the year you got elected?
So they were 4 and 8.
But now they are seeing a mom who's showing them a way to be in the world. Are they really aware?
They are. We make it very discussable. And as they get older, I think they understand the role that I play with the headlines that they read and the conversations that they overhear. But look, there are definitely moments when my youngest says, I don't care if you're saving the world. Can you please quit your job?
Okay, first, do you die a little bit inside when you hear that?
Of course you do. Of course you do. And you know that that moment is fleeting. But I think you have to be very much attuned to that so that, you know, you're very present. I'm very present when my kids are there. I tend not to work when we have these quality moments together. I'm all there for them, and they know that. We do take more proactive time off so that they know when they've got me all to themselves.
What's your favorite thing to do with them when they've got you all to yourself?
You know, it's the simple things. I mean, both my daughters just finished travel basketball seasons, and they love to see me in the stands, like engaged, cheering for them. And I think them just knowing that I'm their mom first is really important to them and really important to my husband and me.
So there's many other things I'm intrigued about here. Let's go next to this collective thought bubble you talked about. So you're deciding to run. Unbeknownst to you, there are thousands of women across America having this collective thought bubble.
Right.
What do you think's in the collective thought bubble today?
There's not enough. We need to keep electing women to office. It really is not just being at the table, but having that collective voice where you start to shift some of those power imbalances. And we've seen that, you know, we've seen that in the Congress, and we need to make that contagious to all levels of government.
You've been a leader most of your life. You've been what I would call, in the best sense of the word, a driven young woman, a driven congresswoman, a driven mom. You talked at the beginning about your call to service, getting that from your family.
Yeah.
What do you have to do before you leave Congress for you to feel like you did your job?
That is a magnificent question, because you always come to Congress with goals. Everything that I do in Congress really is informed by the district that I represent. Before I even got to Congress, you know, the Merrimack Valley gas explosions happened, infected two of the communities in my district, Lawrence being the biggest one. And my goal at the time was, oh my gosh, we need pipeline safety. This can never happen again.
And that was September 2018.
Yes. Yes. And so, you know, it was right after my election, in the middle of my recount, before my general election. And it was the first piece of legislation I, you know, filed, right? So it was the Leonel Rondon Pipeline Safety Act, named after the 18-year-old who passed away during those explosions. And so there's no question that there are things that you couldn't even possibly anticipate. They happen, and they shift your priorities, because the district that you represent, they're counting on you to be their voice in Washington. And so some of them are episodic. When you say, what do I need to do before I leave? I think of the climate crisis and what we have to do to put our country, our planet back on track. For my kids, for their kids, for yours. It's a can we can no longer kick down the road. I really want to make sure the United States continues to be a leader by example on climate, on healthcare, on equity, on making sure that women are, you know, paid and treated as fairly as men. I mean, I've got a long list of goals, but I chip away at them wherever I can find a win. I will take that win and then reassert myself to pushing ahead. But yeah, it can feel daunting, because there are so many things where we need to either catch up or lead. But I'm pretty long on energy.
If you could go anywhere in the world, anywhere, where would you go?
You know, I have not been to Africa yet. I've been able to travel a fair amount. I was a consultant, and so that took me around the world. And there is nothing quite like going to a place for an amount of time where you can really immerse yourself and get to know the people and the culture and the issues. But I haven't, you know, I've got a large West African population in Lowell, and I haven't been to Ghana yet. I would love to go to South Africa.
So one of the things that's been on my mind a lot in getting ready to talk to you is kind of this space that you occupy in our congressional delegation. Mm. And it's an interesting space because on the one hand, you've got somebody like Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, also elected in the big wave, very quickly becomes not only iconic as a member of the quote-unquote squad, but a target, especially of the Trump administration. Yeah. And she and I had a similar conversation to this. We talked about that. You've got Elizabeth Warren, who runs for president. You've got Catherine Clark, who I can't remember the phrase that people use, but she's sort of a stealth bomber who has worked her way up, right, into senior leadership. You are not a woman to be trifled with. But you have not been in the public eye in these last 5 years in the same way that some of the other women who represent the state have been. Mm. And I wonder, A, do you even care? And B, how do you feel about it? C, is it on purpose? I'm just curious. I'm just curious.
Yes, some of it is by design. I've always been a put my head down and do the work that I've set out to do. And, you know, some of that's served me well. And then sometimes, you know, it's I'm not elevating an issue by not being more, you know, sort of out front or in the media on something. And so I try to balance that. Right. Like right now, you know, I'm really vocal on these tech platforms across our country that are harming our children knowingly and willfully.
Social media.
Absolutely. I've been a tough critic from an, you know, age-appropriate design because I see my own children and their, you know, their addiction that can very much form to their devices, as well as just transparency. Now, that's not always an issue that's front and center in people's lives. When you talk to them about it one-on-one, they completely get it. But there are a lot of competing issues, right, in the world. And I think that is the essence of Congress, is we're set up in committees so that we can, you know, focus on the big things and the small things. And sometimes the small things are in our subcommittees and the big things are debated on the House floor. And I toggle that pretty effectively.
Is it fair to say that it's part of your ethic of service that, you know, if it's not a glitzy subject, but it's the one that needs to be worked on and you can work on it, that's where you're going to be?
Yeah, I would say, I approach this job with a lot of humility. And I will go to, you know, the places that are impacting the folks I represent. And I also go to the places where I have lived experience. I mean, there's no coincidence that I'm critical of tech. I worked in tech for a number of years, and I know the power of these algorithms. I worked at a targeting advertising company, for crying out loud. So I know the ad stack well, and I want to push Congress to do more faster in this space. It's just a perfect fit.
Yep.
I also know that moms, when I talk to them in my town meetings, and you know, they talk about the ads that their kids are being served, or the fact that, you know, they can't get their kids off the devices because there's just an autoplay and it just never seems to end. And why should the burden be on me to futz with these parental controls that, by the way, I don't even understand? So that is an area where I know it's simmering. It's really affecting the quality of life for families I represent. And I also just am a natural to go and help fix that problem.
What are you most proud of?
Overall or in Congress?
I think overall.
You know, I'm proud of the fact that I have pushed myself out of my comfort zone a number of times. It's a hard thing to do, and I did it when I left politics the first time to go to the tech sector. I did it again when I started my own company with two other women, the consulting company that was really, at the end, committed to getting more women into leadership roles. And I did it by putting my name on the ballot. And I don't believe that everything comes easy in life, or anything comes easy in life. And I think that has been validated by the risks that I've taken, maybe career risks or the personal risks that I've taken in order to go where I've wanted to go. And along the way, if I can bring more women to the game, if I can elevate you know, women so that people see our power, if I can set the conditions so that women can thrive as casually as men have for centuries, I'm going to do that. And so whatever personal risk or personal sacrifice that I've taken on is hopefully something that women writ large benefit from and get a return on.
You made passing reference earlier in our conversation to the fact that you thought you were going to be in civil service.
Foreign service.
Yes. Wanted to go to Georgetown, Of course, Georgetown is a place to go for foreign service. And then you pivot when your dad gets sick. Mm. How did he feel about that pivot at the time? And does he see the full circle of it now? And what's he most proud of in you now? Because it strikes me just in the way you talk to him about him now and the way you've talked about him other places, that this is a very fundamental figure in your life.
Both my mom and dad are pivotal players in my story. My mom is just loving and graceful, incredibly hardworking. She's got a level of perseverance that, thank God, she passed on to me. My dad, also a hard worker, I think most, you know, sons of and daughters of immigrants are. But it's funny, you know, my dad is now the source of what I've come to know as my incredible optimism. When my dad was diagnosed with MS, I mean, it was just devastating to him and my family. He was an iron worker. He was this big, strong guy, seemed invincible to my sisters and me. And it didn't happen overnight. He has secondary progressive MS, but it happened over time where he would just lose, you know, the ability to balance, which is why he couldn't be an iron worker anymore, and then walk, you know, use the full range of his hands. And now he's in a wheelchair. But I'll tell you one thing. When you see my dad, he's the one lit up with a smile on his face, trying to make you laugh. His coping mechanisms have been life-saving to our family. And look, we went through some real struggles. There are a lot of families who are, you know, one diagnosis away from financial ruin. And of course, the cost of his treatment and his medication was just daunting. And in many cases, dictated how he was going to treat his MS. But, you know, he still figures out a way to lift weights every day, to take a few steps. He's very much still in the game, and he wants to show us that every day. So it is incredible to see when, you know, someone has gotten a setback that it doesn't in any way define him. I've got two girls, three grown stepsons, or my nieces and nephews. You know, every moment with him is really inspiring because I think they get to see a different face of what it means to have a chronic illness and to live with it and how to get up every day and make the most of each day. So yes, he is a very important cast member in this movie.
All right. I've asked you where you want to go in the world. I've asked you what you have to do before you finish Congress. I've asked you what you're proud of. God willing, there's always a next chapter. Is there a dream for you for some other chapter?
You know, it's funny. You set out to do certain things, and I have. I've been very proactive, and I've been very deliberate about some of the moves that I've made. And then you realize some things fall from the sky or an opportunity presents itself that makes you shift.
Like when you hear that Nikki Tsongas is going to retire.
Exactly right. You know, I think about what life would have been like today had Nikki Tsongas not retired, or if Trump hadn't been elected, would I have had the same impetus or the same motivation? You just don't know. And so I'm very much open to the possibilities that present themselves. And I don't know what the next thing is going to be. And I say that candidly, honestly, with a lot of humility. What I've liked about my life so far is that I've gone to where I can have an impact. And that's still very important to me. It's very purposeful for me to, you know, bring all the skills or the lived experience that I have so that I can unleash it all to great effect. I still feel like I've just gotten to, you know, Congress. You know, this Congress is an exciting one. I'm not only on energy and commerce, but I am the senior whip for our whip, Catherine Clark. I'm our regional rep on the implementation, the regional council for the White House to make sure that everything we've passed with infrastructure and chips and science. But, you know, you never know. You never know. And I look forward to that inflection point. I've enjoyed them all.
That is Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's end today on the North Shore, where they are working to honor Indigenous life and culture in Gloucester, past and present. This year marks 400 years since English colonial settlers came to the area we call Gloucester. To mark that event and its full implication, which includes impact on Indigenous life and culture, the Cape Ann Museum is coordinating a citywide effort of exhibits and installments from now into the fall. It's called Native Waters, Native Lands. Oliver Barker is director of the Cape Ann Museum, and Stephen Peters is the creative director of the organization Smoke Signals, a Wampanoag curatorial firm who's partnering with the Cape Ann Museum on this initiative. Oliver, welcome.
Tiziana, thank you so much. I so appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Great to have you. And Steve, welcome to you too.
Thank you for having me.
So Steve, I'm going to start with you. Native Water, Native Lands. Why that title and what does it mean to you and your work?
Yeah, it means everything to us. You know, for us, it's about being able to tell the story and history and culture of my ancestors in the voice of the people that are here today. And for us, it's about getting history right.
So I'm struck by you saying the history and culture of the ancestors in the voices of the people that are here today. When we did our hour-long Indigenous Peoples Day conversation, one of the things that our guests kept reminding us was, we talk about we now need to honor Indigenous history, but it's equally important to recognize and embrace the Indigenous present. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. I mean, there's really been a lot of miscommunication about what happened to our people in the past and the fact that we're still here today. And that, for us, is important. People need to know that Indigenous people continue to thrive on these lands. And it's important that our voice is heard.
So, Oliver, I'll turn to you. This marks 400 years since English colonial settlers came to the land that we now call Gloucester. Why is it important for the museum to honor Indigenous life and culture in this 400th marking, right, of 400 years?
Well, 400 years is certainly a wonderful milestone for colonial engagement here on Cape Ann. But as a museum, we want to tell the stories of the past and the present and also the future. And we saw that there was a real opportunity here to work closely with Steve and Smoke Signals and other city partners in drawing, in highlighting the fact that there is a much longer history to be told here. It goes back 12,000 years. And fortunately for the museum, we have a collection of native artifacts, a small collection that we show regularly. And we're looking to this year, of course, to highlight that collection and ensure that there is a strong native presence in the future moving forward.
So let's stay there. So we said at the top, you know, there's installations, there's art. I know there will be a festival in the fall, but I want to start with these five objects that are just going on display at the Cape Ann Museum. They're on loan from the Peabody Essex Museum. They'll be displayed for the next 5 years. Next 1 year, five objects.
Yes.
Three drills, two works of art, and this is that 400 years versus 10 or 12,000 years. So just tell us a little bit about those objects.
So we have these five wonderful objects. Three of them are drill bits that date back 10,000 years. And then more recently, to represent what is happening today and the fact that there is an active native presence and use of these lands and these waters that we all now collectively call home, we are showing the work of a Wampanoag artist, a wonderful clay jar that was made by Glanis Widdis in the year 2000. And the fifth object that we're showing is a piece by, a Wampanoag artist who was here at the beginning of the 20th century, someone by the name of Emma Jane Mitchell Safford. And we have on display a wonderful basket that she likely made for made around 1890. And so that will be on display too.
So I want to stay there in that space for a minute, Steve Peters, because one of the conversations that we've been having in public a lot lately is who owns Native artifacts, the display of them, who claims their curation, their presentation. So understanding that that is a public conversation now, how do you think about the presence of these five artifacts at the Cape Ann Museum coming from the Peabody Essex Museum today?
That's a real challenging topic for us. And it's one of the things that we continue to try and improve with the museums that we work with, and understanding that they need to start thinking about, where do these objects and these belongings truly, should they reside? Should they go back to the tribes where they came from? We think they should. We think the museums themselves are starting to understand that. They're starting to understand that they can't necessarily control the voice and the history the way that it had been told, and that it needs to be told in the voice of the people that descend from it. So we're very hopeful that museums will start thinking more about giving these belongings back so that they can be back with the people who deserve to have them.
So, Oliver, where is the Cape Ann Museum on that journey? How are you thinking about it?
Well, we have a collection of over 400 objects ourselves, and at present we're delighted to be sharing them with the community. They're always on display, or a selection of them are on display in the museum. And to me, it helps us tell the very rich and long story of Cape Ann as a influential place in terms of human occupation. And so we are excited, we're delighted that PEM, who has a very substantive collection of Indigenous artifacts.
That's Peabody Essex Museum.
Exactly. Yeah. Has so generously allowed us to show objects that we don't ourselves have. And to me, I'm very excited that we have this opportunity to partner with Steve so that we can ensure that in presenting them, we do so in a very thoughtful way. And we reflect the voice of the Wampanoag and the native peoples, which is just so important to make sure that as a museum, we embrace that voice and share it with our audiences.
We're talking about a citywide and collaborative effort to mark 400 years since English colonial settlers came to the Cape Ann area. We have here Oliver Barker of the Cape Ann Museum and Steve Peters, who's the creative director of Smoke Signals. And Steve, I'm going to come to you. So we've talked about the five artifacts now. There's this other dimension that I think is really interesting because we're talking about then and now. Mm-hmm. And it's these two pieces of, I don't want to call them, okay, you tell me. It's a Witu and a Mishun. Right. Do we call those artifacts, physical tools, structure? I mean, how to think about them in the context of what Gloucester's doing in the Cape Ann Museum and you are doing this year?
Yeah, for us, it is. It's art. It's a vehicle for engaging the community to come in and want to learn more, wanting them to challenge the history maybe that they were taught when they were in school when they were young, and saying, well, if that's not accurate, then what else isn't? And so we use these big installations like the Mishun, like a Witu, to bring people in and start to ask questions, want to learn more. We can't tell 12,000 years of history in one small space. We can't do that. But what we can do is engage the community to want to learn more. And so having this Witu structure come up, and it's big, it's beautiful, the way that it comes together in the dome shape.
Tell people what it is.
Yeah. So it's for us, we're going to build it out of these cedar saplings. We're going to harvest those actually next month. And we form them into a dome shape that would have been the frame for one of our traditional homes that we would have lived in. They were extremely efficient, and they were warm in the winter and they were cool in the summer. But for us, we want to use that as really a place where we can start to build contemporary art around it as well. So we want to use that traditional structure and then add contemporary art in there to reinforce that. As Indigenous people, we are still here.
The then and now.
The then and now.
And just out of curiosity, where do you harvest the saplings from?
From cedar swamps all throughout southeastern Massachusetts.
So, Oliver Barker, there is something really powerful, right, about a museum engaging in work that is new creation, that is watching art emerge and then putting it in the context of a story that's a bigger story than we used to tell.
Yes.
A more complete story and an important story.
Completely. I think it, to me, it's particularly exciting. The museum this week just celebrated 148 years of existence. And to me, everything that, Steve, you've been sharing is so exciting that this WE2 is going to be installed at the museum's new Cape Air Museum Green Campus. It's going to be seen in juxtaposition with a wonderful new building, the James Centre, that we built in 2020 to better engage our community and enable us to better tell the stories of Cape Ann as a place. But also it's going to be seen alongside two historic homes, a house that was built in 1710 and a house that was built in 1740. And to have that juxtaposition of these structures at the entranceway for anyone who comes and arrives in to visit Gloucester or Rockport, two of the main centres of Cape Ann, is completely thrilling to me that we as a museum have the opportunity to bring the story forward in new and very relevant ways.
So I wasn't expecting to ask this, but Steve, yesterday we had a conversation about the history of Malcolm X in Boston. One of the things that we talked about was a failure by the city to mark as landmarks until relatively recently, for example, the house that Malcolm X lived in Roxbury as a teenager. So here we're talking about, you know, historic houses, and I'm using air quotes, 300 or 400 years old, and you're talking about structures that are thousands of years old in practice and living. It does underscore that what have we preserved as history and what have we not? And I'm not assuming that a WE2 is meant to last hundreds and hundreds of years, but I think you understand my question.
I think I do, yeah. And for us, you know, having these structures there is a great way to challenge what we've held as truth. You know, what we've held on to as civility, what we've held on to as savagery, you know, those were things that we were taught by institutions, schools, museums, books that we've looked at it through history. They've told us what was civility, what was savagery. Now we're using our place to start to question that and say, you know, what really happened? And then how has it impacted us today? Because once people understand history correctly, they then can be a little bit more compassionate for where people sit today.
So Oliver, in a sentence or two, from your perspective, what's the invitation?
The invitation is to come visit, is to embrace the full story of Cape Ann, a story that goes back well beyond the 400 plus years to 12,000 years ago, and join us in that exploration in really understanding the full history of this place.
And Steve Peters, in your words, the invitation is?
The invitation is to come and learn, question what we had been taught and what is truth.
Steve Peters is the creative director of the organization Smoke Signals, a Wampanoag curatorial firm. Oliver Barker is the director of the Cape Ann Museum. 400 years being, I won't say celebrated, I'll say observed, with some amazing installations and art and displays over the next several months. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Amanda Beeland and Rob Lane with Bart Tachi and John Bender. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Folladoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.